Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Illegal guns are often at the center of tragedy, and efforts to control the sale of guns to criminals and terrorists always are with us. So are the forces that oppose those efforts. We've brought a few of them to the show today. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg is a major proponent of tougher gun control laws. He formed the Mayors Against Illegal Guns to move those proposals forward. We asked him to join the show, but he declined. Joining us today, however, in his place is one of his advisors, Arkady Gurney. He is the City of New York's Firearms Policy Coordinator. Welcome to the show, Arkady.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Also, the City of Columbus's Police Chief, Walter Distelswag. Chief, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
And joining us in about 20 minutes, Buckeye Firearms Association Legislative Chair Ken Hansen will be with us. Arkady, tell us about the Mayors Against Illegal Drugs. When was it formed and why was it formed?
Mayors Against Illegal Guns was started 4 years ago. It started as a group of 15 mayors who were called together by Mayor Bloomberg in New York and Mayor Tom Menino of Boston. And it's grown to more than 500 mayors from all over the country, including a big group of mayors from Ohio, 39 Ohio mayors, including Mayor Coleman in Columbus, but really most of the big cities in the state, Cincinnati, Cleveland, Akron, but also a lot of the smaller towns, because this issue of gun violence is something that affects big cities and small cities all over the country. And that's why it's a diverse group of mayors, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, from every corner of the country who've come together. And the basic idea around it is to pursue common sense policies that will aim towards the goal of keeping guns out of the hands of criminals.
What are your major goals in keeping what are the major issues, I suppose, in that respect?
I think that there are a few sets of issues. One of them, I think, involves the gun background check system. So we do have, since the Brady Bill was signed into law in 1993, we have a system where gun dealers have to do background checks when they sell a gun. And that system has been remarkably successful in that it prevents every year more than 70,000 felons and domestic abusers and other people who are prohibited under federal law from buying a gun from actually being able to do that at a gun store. But unfortunately, there's some gaps in the background check system, and those are gaps that the mayors are working to close. And one of the most glaring gaps in gun background checks is what's been called the gun show loophole. And that issue is that while these licensed gun dealers, people who have a place of business, they have to do background checks, and sometimes the licensed gun dealers will be at gun shows, and they do the background checks at gun shows. There are people who maintain that they are just merely collectors of guns, and they're also selling guns at gun shows, but they don't have the license, they're not doing any paperwork, and they're not doing background checks. And unfortunately, we've seen at gun shows and at gun shows in Ohio that there are people, these unlicensed sellers, who are often selling tens of guns, hundreds of guns at show after show without background checks.
What is the language missing in the legislation or the law that would close that loophole, that would have closed it? What was missing? Did it just not recognize the unlicensed dealers as well?
Well, you know, a number of states have closed this loophole, and they've done it in a few different ways. But basically, the most common way is to require that every gun sold at a gun show goes through a background check. And that's a relatively easy thing to do because the licensed sellers are there. And so what the unlicensed sellers would do is they would go to the licensed dealer and have that dealer process the check for them. That's what a number of states require. There are 15 states around the country that have closed the gun show loophole. And we've looked at ATF gun tracing data. That's the data about guns recovered in crimes. And we found that on average, the states that have closed the gun show loophole are 2.5 times less often a source of guns recovered in crimes in other states than states where the gun show loophole has been left open. And so what that means is that criminals and gun traffickers are exploiting this gap in the law to access illegal guns, and those are the guns that are often very often ending up in the streets and being used in crimes to terrorize big cities and small towns all over the country.
As to that figure, you said 2.5 times less likely for a gun to land up in the hands of a criminal.
It's Yes, it's the rate at which guns supply states to the illegal market, or guns recovered in other states, and the states that have closed the gun show loophole are two and a half supply guns to the illegal market at 2.5 times a lower rate.
Could that be a function, however, of the fact that the gun shows don't operate in those states anymore?
Or less often? That's not been the experience.
Okay.
One state that got a lot of attention on the gun show issue was Colorado, because in 1999 there was the Columbine school massacre that I think a lot of folks will remember. In that case, that was two underage people. They shouldn't have had the ability to get guns. Those guns were bought in these unlicensed sales at gun shows, and they used those guns to kill 12 students and teachers at the Columbine High School. After the Columbine school massacre, the people of Colorado voted in a referendum, 70% of the people of Colorado, to close the gun show loophole in Colorado. If you look at Colorado, there's still lots of gun shows in Colorado. It hasn't driven them out of business, which is what some of the opponents said about that. There's still lots of gun shows. But the rate at which they're supplying guns to the illegal market has dropped a lot since that law was passed in 2000.
You're listening to Arkady Gurney. He is the City of New York's Firearms Policy Coordinator for New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. We're talking about illegal guns and how to stop them from landing in the wrong hands. Also with me today is the City of Columbus's Police Chief Walter Distelzweig. And joining us in a little while, Buckeye Firearms Association Legislative Chair / lobbyist, I suppose, Ken Hansen. What about those straw sales, Arkady?
Yeah, that's another big source of guns to the illegal market, and what we've seen is that these are the two main ways ATF has identified that criminals get guns. One is these gun shows, and the other is straw sales. And the straw sale is basically a situation where a person who cannot buy a gun works with someone who can. And so very often two people will go into a gun store and one person will select the gun, pick it out, dry fire it, pay for the gun, and walk away for it. But when it comes time to fill out the background check, they'll call over another person to do that. And the City of New York did a investigation of straw sales and illegal sales at gun shows, and we looked at some of the straw sales that the licensed dealers were doing. We looked in Ohio, and we found that in 7 of 8 instances in Ohio, these licensed dealers, when they were presented with a straw sale scenario, would in fact sell the gun. And to do a knowing straw sale is against the law, so the dealers really shouldn't do it. ATF, the federal agency that regulates firearms and investigates gun trafficking, has a program called Don't Lie for the Other Guy to deal with straw sales. But unfortunately, there are still dealers who enable them, and it's really the top way that criminals get guns. So it's something that that law enforcement really needs to keep an eye on, and resources would help to do that, to inspect gun dealers more frequently and to be able to do more investigations. And unfortunately, ATF hasn't had as much resources as some of the other federal law enforcement agencies. And one of the things that the Mayors Against Illegal Guns have been calling for is to get more resources to ATF to be able to do some of the things it would like to do. It has a goal of inspecting gun dealers at least once every 3 years, but given the resources that they have right now, they're only inspecting gun dealers once every 11 years. So I think one of the goals that I think all sides on the gun debate have talked about supporting is enforcing the laws on the books, and that's something that the mayors strongly support, and we want to see that ATF and local law enforcement around the country have the resources to do that.
What do you estimate would be necessary to adequately fund ATF?
Well, the Mayors Against Illegal Guns sent a series of recommendations from these 500 mayors to the Obama administration and Attorney General Holder last year. Mm-hmm. And in that document, we recommended about a 10% increase in ATF's budget. So that's a significant increase, but actually would be less new money to ATF than to some of the money that has been going to the other federal law enforcement agencies. particularly after September 11th, when FBI and Customs and Border Patrol had a lot of new responsibilities on the Homeland Security front, it's mm-hmm. pulled resources away from the basic task of law enforcement, which is to fight gun trafficking and drug trafficking and these other kinds of situations that fuel crime in cities across the country. And what the mayors want to make sure is that that ATF and has the resources to work on this effectively, because when they do do these investigations, they can be quite effective, and there are every week there are new prosecutions across the country of people who are illegally trafficking guns.
Chief, what about the city and its resources? How difficult is it to enforce these laws at the level of a city like Columbus?
Well, it is difficult. One of the things that we look at is where do the guns come from, and then once we do, come up with a crime and we have a gun, we trace that gun to try to get the history. Sometimes that helps us in our prosecution. Sometimes it doesn't. But we have an initiative right now going on for gun violence, pretty much targeting guns and gangs and drugs. But it's an issue that I think all of our major cities in the United States are dealing with right now.
Last year, an amendment. Well, one of the things that I wanted to bring up is the irony that possibly that the funding is shifted to anti-terrorist work, because there's not one of the things that falls through that loophole is the fact that people on the terrorist watch list are able to purchase guns at these shows.
That's right. I mean, I think that one of the things that people find pretty surprising is that people who are on the terrorist watch list, people who the federal government has deemed too dangerous to get on an airplane, are able to go to a gun dealer and pass the background check right now, because the FBI doesn't have the ability to block sales to people on the terror watch list. And that's something that the Bush administration Justice Department wrote the legislation to give the FBI that authority. The Obama administration Justice Department supports that legislation as well, but unfortunately Congress hasn't passed it. The NRA leadership opposes closing what we call this terror gap to give FBI the authority to block these sales. But interestingly, there was a poll done in December of last year by Frank Luntz, the prominent Republican pollster, and he found that 82% of NRA members would support blocking sales to people on the terror watch list. So this is one of the another glaring gap in background checks, a pretty common sense thing to do, and something that's pretty urgent to do, because the General Accountability Office did a study which came out just a couple of weeks ago and found that there have been more than 1,100 incidences of where people on the terror watch list were able to buy guns and explosives from licensed dealers in the United States over the last 6 years.
We have to take a short break. You're listening to Arkady Gurney of the City of New York. He's a special advisor to the mayor, and also City of Columbus's Police Chief Walter Distelswag. And joining us after this break, Buckeye Firearms Association Legislative Chair Ken Hansen. We'll try to get your calls and emails in as well. Give us a call if you want, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Get the stories behind the headlines every day on All Things Considered.
The numbers are startling. Ohio's maternal death rate has more than doubled over the past two decades. Some suggest the changes in record keeping account for the increase.
Some of it is certainly maybe due to the identification of cases.
She says overall, women are higher risk these days.
On your drive home, listen to award-winning coverage from the WOSU news team on WOSU 89.7 FM.
And you're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. 61 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1020 this morning. Cloudy skies today with a chance of rain throughout the day and a high of 65. Clouds tonight with a good chance of rain overnight and a low of 53.
Support for WOSU comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about illegal guns and how to stop the transfer of them into the hands of criminals. Joining us today is Arkady Gurney. He's the City of New York Special Advisor to the Mayor on firearms policy. Also, City of Columbus's Police Chief Walter Distelzweig. And joining us now, Buckeye Firearms Association Legislative Chair Ken Hansen. Ken, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
Ken, we're talking about topics that probably are very familiar to you. One of them is the gun show loophole and the way the ATF at the federal level and local law enforcement struggles with that at the, you know, regarding the gun shows. Now, there aren't any in Columbus, but there are have been them often in Central Ohio. So can you address the first the gun show loophole and why that can't be closed or why what the dangers are in closing it?
Well, I think first thing you need to understand about the gun show loophole is what we're really talking about is a living room loophole. Private individuals have the ability to sell their own firearms to other private individuals right now, you know, in my office, in my family room, in my driveway. Those are not licensed, not supervised transactions. So when we're talking about gun shows, those transactions are regulated. We have the FFLs at gun shows having to go through the exact same background checks that they would in the gun shop. Watching Mayor Bloomberg's press conference back when he announced the results of this undercover operation, the thing that continued to strike me was the use of the word illegal. Mm-hmm. Illegal means it's illegal. It's illegal under current law. Now, one of the big things that they brought up about the gun shows were the private sellers, private collection type of dealers that are at these shows. And again, using the word illegal is appropriate because that conduct is illegal under current law. So it's an enforcement issue, not a loophole. If they're out there enforcing the laws, that conduct would stop. What we're really talking about is the private person-to-person sales of firearms. Now, if you look at these bills that they, you know, have introduced to quote unquote close the gun show loophole, for instance, H.R. 2324, just asking, I mean, Chief, have you read that law?
No, I have not.
Okay, Ann, have you read that law?
No.
Okay, I mean,
Arkady, have you read the law?
Yes.
Okay.
I had no doubt about that. I wasn't meaning to demean you by omission.
That's okay.
Made the assumption.
No problem.
I mean, included in closing the gun show loophole, no later than 30 days prior to the gun show promoter must notify the Attorney General of the time and place of the gun show, the hours, and give a list of everyone who is going to be selling at the show together with identifying information. And then after the gun show, make written report of the make, model, serial number, you know, all of that, of the guns transferred at the show. So really, I mean, it's not about imposing background checks through these bills. What we're doing is we're putting gun shows out of business.
Where are we putting them out of business? Because I asked about that earlier. For instance, in Colorado, where they've enacted tougher laws, there's still gun shows operating.
Yeah, let me say, if we're talking about a pure background check provision, no, that's not going to put a gun show out of business. H.R. 2324 clearly would put the gun shows out of business because you're not going to get gun show promoters that are able to identify by name and identification and examine each person's identification, you know, piece of identification 30 days prior to the show and make that report to the Attorney General together with any other information the Attorney General administratively determines is necessary, and then make report of the make, model, and serial number of every gun being transferred at the show. I mean, that's gun registration, and that is going to kill the gun show.
Is your and the Buckeye Firearms Association recommendation to solve this problem strictly a matter of enforcement? In other words, if there was just more money for enforcement, they could do their job and that would be the end of it?
I think a common sense approach before we adopt new laws is to enforce the ones we already have, which is not happening. Let's give it a good, honest effort to enforce the laws that are on the books, see what that result is, see what the experience is, and then if there's some sort of tweak or addition that needs to be done to it, we can sit down at that point and then talk. But all this conduct being complained of is always called illegal. And again, it's called illegal because it's illegal under current laws. And if it's illegal under current laws, let's start enforcing the current laws.
Arkady, is it really, I mean, you mentioned that enforcement would solve a lot of the problem as well, and that there needs to be better funding at the ATF, and Chief Distelzweig said at the local level as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, I think there'd probably be a lot of common ground between Ken and I, at least based on what Ken just said, in that absolutely think there needs to be better enforcement of the laws already on the books, and that means getting more resources to ATF and ATF doing some things to look more aggressively at people who are selling guns in violation of current laws. So I think I would certainly join Ken in advocating for more resources to go to ATF and local law enforcement to fight gun trafficking and to enforce the laws already on the books. Ken said that he doesn't like the House bill on the gun show loophole that's there right now. There's different legislation in the Senate. There was a bill introduced in 2004 by John McCain to close the gun show loophole that was another way of doing it. So what I think there, if Ken agrees that there should be background checks on every gun sold at a gun show, that's something we certainly support. And if there are other ways to do it other than the legislation that's in the House, we'd be very open to thinking about other ways to do it. My understanding of the provisions that he described is that it's to ensure that the background checks are actually taking place, and that for those reasons you'd want to have ATF and the Justice Department know when the gun show is happening and know who the sellers are at the gun show. But it wouldn't keep any personally identifiable information about the guns sold, so there wouldn't be any registry or list of the people who bought the guns. But it would allow ATF to enforce the provision, and to ensure that if a gun is later found in a crime, that it could be traced back to that sale at a gun show, and they would be able to, in the circumstance of a crime gun trace, identify the source of that gun.
Ken, what about the terror gap? We were talking earlier. It's kind of counterintuitive. It's sort of a dichotomy in this day and age when funding has been shifted from places like the ATF to better fund anti-terrorism efforts in the United States, and yet if you're a terrorist, you're still not screened out of gun sales.
That's not true.
Okay.
Part of the FFL's process is we run the NICS check, and as the FBI testified in front of Congress, that includes checking the terrorist database, period, end. It's included.
Arkady?
They check the terror database, but they're not able to block the sale. And what the Justice Department and the FBI have asked for, they asked for this in the Bush administration when they sent this legislation to Congress, and the Attorney General Holder reiterated his support for it now, is that not only should we be able to identify when somebody on the terror watch list has attempted to purchase a gun, we should be able to block the sale. Because more than 1,100 times in the last 6 years, those sales have actually gone through. And that's a real risk, because there have been many incidents in the United States in recent years where terrorists have used guns to kill Americans. That's what happened at Fort Hood. There was a shooting in Arkansas where someone who had connections to terror groups in Yemen shot up a Army-Navy recruiting post, killing one soldier and wounding another. There was a plot to attack Quantico, FBI's training facility, and there was a plot to attack Fort Dix in New Jersey.
And in each of these cases, if they had been – these are examples of where the sale should have been blocked and wasn't?
Some of these cases involve cases where someone who had been previously identified as a terror suspect. Some of them do not. So not in every case would this ability have stopped the sale. But you know, this is an obvious. You want to make it harder for terrorists to get guns, not easier. And this is an obvious solution. There's no silver bullet to this. Obviously, if you close the terror gap from licensed gun dealers, terrorists would be able to. Or terror suspects would be able to go to gun shows in many states and buy guns without background checks. So there's no silver bullet, but we do know when we look at gun trafficking or drug trafficking, when we make it harder for criminals, crime goes down. And we've had great success all over the country in cities, large and small, of having a targeted approach to crime. We've seen in New York City, for example. We've gone from 2,000 murders a year in the late 1980s to less than 500 murders last year. 500 is still a big number, mm-hmm. but we're making great progress in fighting crime. And you know, to do that, you want to be smart. You want to make it harder on the criminals, mm-hmm. Not easier. And the gun show loophole and closing the terror gap are two pretty common sense things to do.
Ken, one of the tactics that Mayor Bloomberg and the mayors have used is these sting operations in places like Central Ohio and Colorado and elsewhere. And at least one state has passed a law, I believe, that would ban these sorts of sting operations. And I think there's an effort underway in West Virginia. I think it was Virginia that's banned it. And West Virginia has legislation pending that would ban it, and might be wrong about that. But how do you feel about those sting operations? Are they a good thing because they ward off the illegal transactions or what?
The mayor's jurisdiction ends at the city line.
Well, yeah, but
it's that simple.
Chief Disselswag?
Well, you know, for local law enforcement, we're really at the tail end of this discussion, mm-hmm. because we respond to the crimes that are committed. We've had 40 homicides in Columbus this year already. 35 of those involved a firearm. And so what our job then is to try to figure out, if we can, where that firearm came from and if there's any connection to, people that should not be and should not have a firearm. So, the city of Columbus does not have gun shows, and so we have no jurisdiction over the gun shows or the selling or the buying or anything like that. But like I say, I think basically for local law enforcement, you know, we kind of clean up the mess at the end. And it does create issues as far as where are the guns coming from?
Mm-hmm. Ken, you're saying they have no jurisdiction, but has that been brought to court yet?
The only actual lawsuit I'm aware of was not this past sting, but the sting before that. I think one of the Georgia dealers actually went to court on it. Okay. But, I mean, it's not something you need a court case for. He is the mayor of New York City, not the mayor of the United States. His authority ends at the city limits. Now, you know, when we're talking about these out-of-state guns and trafficking and stuff like that, the ATF trace data for 2009 is still showing an average time to crime for guns recovered in New York of over 12 years. The FBI, in their press release, says we only consider it trafficking on a case where it's 1 year or less. Anything beyond that is not indicative of trafficking. Pennsylvania provided more firearms to New York, as far as the ones that are traced, than Ohio did. And Pennsylvania has, the universal background check for handguns. I don't see the nexus between the gun show sales and the guns that are being recovered in New York. That's just not been shown, and the statistics I've seen are less than 1% of the guns recovered are gun show guns.
Ken, are you satisfied with the amount of information or lack thereof that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives shares with city and state law enforcement agencies?
I prosecute for a small village here in Delaware County, and if we need information on a gun, we go to the ATF, they trace it. If we can get the trace results, then we proceed with the investigation if that information is needed. What we have now is something like roughly half of the guns recovered that we can't properly trace, mm-hmm. and that's due to serial number obliteration or the fact that they were never legally in the United States to begin with. They're being imported. I mean, a 50-pound bale of marijuana is a very large package. Getting a few handguns into the country is a piece of cake when it comes down to that. Now, Chief, I know you're saying, we've started having gun shows back at Vets Memorial here in the last 6 months or so, and I'm not aware of any problems or allegations of problems or any source issues that have been raised by anyone in law enforcement from those shows.
Not that I'm aware of. And again, it's, as you talked about, the tracing of the gun, you know, somebody can buy a gun legally, have the gun stolen, and how many other hands does it end up in before you know, law enforcement becomes involved? And so, you know, I guess, you know, part of the issue is that it's, you know, how do we control human nature in the use of these guns?
Arkady, what about the mayor's group does want to have more information shared between ATF and local agencies, isn't that right?
That's right, and you know, the mayor's called for some changes to be made in these in certain restrictions on local and state law enforcement access to gun trace data, and we're pleased that there a number of positive changes have been made. It used to be that trace data was only available to state and local law enforcement on a case-by-case basis, solely for a particular investigation or prosecution, but because of changes made in 2007 and then changes made again in, by the Obama administration and Congress last year, now trace data is completely available to state and local law enforcement. That's a big improvement, and ATF now has the ability to release aggregate trace data, meaning giving some of the overall trace data on trafficking patterns across state lines. That's something that they didn't have a few years ago but was put back in 2007. So there have been improvements. There are still some restrictions, particularly on lawmakers and the press access to data, and we think those are not ideal because it prevents a robust public debate about how guns are moving across state lines, and there's more information that could be shared that ought to be shared. But there have been a lot of improvements made, and I think that has a lot to do with mayors and police chiefs around the country requesting these changes, and I think that's important because you have to understand the problem if you're going to do something about it. And straw purchases is an issue. Unlicensed sales at gun shows is an issue. Certainly lost and stolen guns is an issue. But you want to have as much information as possible because smart policing these days really means connecting the dots and putting your resources where it's going to make the biggest difference. And we've that's made a big difference for cutting down crime in New York City, but it's also making a difference in cities all over the country.
Ken, last year an amendment almost passed in the Defense Appropriations Bill that would have allowed the transport of concealed weapons over state lines. Does Buckeye Firearms Association have a position on that issue?
I believe what you're referring to is the nationwide reciprocity, where like my Ohio license is good in the other 49 states.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to make sure we were talking about the same thing. Yes, of course we support that. I mean, my Ohio driver's license, I can drive in any of the 49 states. My training, my qualifications, Ohio has licensed me to do it. My ability to remain safe, law-abiding, et cetera, doesn't change at the state line. I'm still the same person, just like Chief referred to. How are you going to police human nature? The Times Square bomber, for instance, here's someone that went through the U.S. citizenship process, went through a two-week waiting period and a NICS check before he bought his rifle. We're not going to be able to legislate away problems. We're not going to be able to legislate away crime. I mean, it's just human nature that we're talking about. So striking the balance between, overregulation and what's reasonable, allowing me to travel to the other 49 states, I just don't see where I would be creating a risk if I was in New York City or upstate New York or any of the other 48 states carrying the gun. I'm the same person that I am in Ohio.
Now, do all states allow concealed weapons now?
48 states have a concealed carry license. Of those states,
okay, so you're talking about, okay.
Three of them don't require any license at all. As long as you're not under firearm disability, you can carry a concealed firearm.
We have to take a break. Arkady, we have to take a quick break right now. And, Ken, you're welcome to hang on with us if you're feeling up to it. I know you have bronchitis, but you're welcome to stay. We have some emails and a call or two. So we'll be right back to take care of that. If you'd like to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Capital City Radio is the new HD radio service from WOSU. Hear music and news that goes beyond anything else in and around Columbus. Get a fresh perspective on the news with shows like The Takeaway, Here and Now, and The World. Explore a mix of old and new music from a variety of genres and keep up with the local music scene. Listen to Capital City Radio on HD3 89.7 FM or online at capitalcityradio.org.
And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of the program will be here, and we'll hear about House Bill 176, the Equal Housing and Employment Act, to prohibit sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination in Ohio. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Westfield Insurance, exclusive sponsor of In the Know, where St. Charles meets Delaware Hayes in this season's final match on Friday at 8 p.m. on WOSU+. Westfield Insurance, sharing knowledge, building trust.
61 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies today with a chance of rain throughout the day, and a high of 65. Clouds tonight with a good chance of rain overnight as well, a low of 53. Cloudy for Wednesday and only a slight chance of rain, a high of 68 degrees. Looking ahead to Thursday, sunshine and a high of 76. All Sides continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest today is Arkady Gurney. He is the City of New York's Firearms Policy Coordinator and an advisor to New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Arkady, once again, welcome to the show. Also, Buckeye Firearms Association Legislative Chair Ken Hansen. Ken, thanks for hanging on with us.
You're welcome.
And City of Columbus Police Chief Walter Distelswag. Chief, glad you're here with us.
Okay, thank you.
We have an email right now we'll get to. If you want to email us, go to allsides@wosu.org. And this is from a listener. Writes, I work at a gun shop and target range in central Ohio, and I agree with most everything your guest from New York says about closing the gun show loophole. However, as a dealer, I don't agree with his accusation of dealers permitting straw sales and looking the other way. This is very serious, and it happens quite often, and as soon as this is picked up on by myself or a coworker, which is very easy to do, we ask them to leave. The ATF is focusing on little mistakes in paperwork as a result of human error and seemingly spend much less time on more important things. This is what they concentrate on when they come for an audit. Arkady, do you agree or disagree? This is just one person's point of view.
I think I largely agree. I mean, most gun dealers are following the law. We know from ATF gun tracing data that in a given year, 1.2% of the nation's gun dealers were the original source of 57% of the guns recovered and traced in crimes, while 85% of the nation's gun dealers didn't have a single trace associated with them. So most gun dealers are following the law, and it's a handful of gun dealers who are operating at the edge of the law who are a problem. ATF tries to focus their resources on the gun dealers that are the most problematic, but there are many restrictions that stand in ATF's way and also a lack of resources that I think prohibit them from doing the best job that they could. But I think I largely agree. I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting that the gun dealer supports closing the gun show loophole, and that's not surprising because it puts, you know, you have at gun shows these licensed sellers who are collecting state sales taxes, who are doing the paperwork, and who are most of them, you know, doing their very best to follow the law to try to prohibit guns going into the hands of criminals and other prohibited persons. But they have to compete against these unlicensed sellers one table over who've got for sale hundreds of guns sometimes. During this undercover investigation the city of New York did in Ohio, we had one unlicensed gun seller tell us that he sold 348 assault rifles in the last year. So no matter how you talk about it, selling 348 guns in a year is being engaged in the business. That person should be getting a license, and what they're doing is breaking the law and putting the licensed sellers at a big disadvantage. So I think the same rules should apply mm-hmm. to anyone who's selling a gun at a gun show. Go through a background check. It's easy to do, and it can help prevent guns from moving into the illegal market.
Ken, I was going to ask you about that first. You know, glad to have you respond to the emailer, but also I wondered if there's any conflicts between the licensed gun sellers and the other gun sellers that are not required to be licensed, and over this issue of the loophole.
Sure, I have an FFL myself, and you know I've gone through the process and abide by the rules. And I think Arkady's, you know, described it accurately that the people that have gone through the time and expense of getting the FFL, getting the vendor's licenses, collecting the sales tax, you know, remitting that every 6 months and all that, they do not want these unlicensed sellers at the shows competing for their business because, you know, part of your overhead is compliance with all these laws, and the people at the table right next to you are not. I would say yes, that, you know, there's probably a fair number of FFLs that would look at that as unfair competition. But again, to stress, that's illegal under current law, and we could be the guy who sold 348 assault rifles. That sounds like a slam dunk. Dealing without a license case.
614-292-8513 if you'd like to speak to any of the guests today. And Robert, you're on the air. You want to talk about terminology.
Yeah, you know what? I think that it's a big mistake, and I think some of these laws are just a confusion of the issue. I think by framing the issue as gun control, because I don't think the problem is, you know, hunting guns or even gun shows or even assault rifles or rednecks forming little armies on the countryside. I'm just not afraid of those people. What the problem is handguns causing chaos in our low-income urban centers. And I think that's a problem for everyone, because now poverty is a form of, you know, coercion against working people. And I think the chief that you know, had the statistics about murders in the city and how many of them were guns. How many of them were handguns?
You know, that I don't know. I just know it was some type of firearm.
Well, I just think carrying an explosive device in a populated area, especially when you don't have training, is the bad idea.
So what would you do, Robert?
Well, you know, I think places in the world that have been able to get the handguns out of their population, like Canada, where they have handguns for people that need them. It's part of Dudley Do-Right's costume to have a handgun, but not every person needs to walk around Toronto with a gun in their pocket.
Well, now, you know, Ken, you'd call that gun control, wouldn't you?
I would call it handgun
control. Okay.
All right. I'm sitting here looking at a Canadian $5 bill with the picture of Sir Wilfrid Lanier on it that was sent to us by a Canadian citizen talking about their gun registry and what an absolute failure it has been and how it has had no impact on fighting crime.
Well, they get a lot fewer gun murders there than they do here, and there are a lot more guns there than there are here. So 75% of Canadians' households have a gun, and because they don't have these things that you can point at your own face, you know, or things that are not very good for maintaining a well-regulated militia, but are perfect for robbing a liquor store, you know, are not rife throughout their country. And I think that's that by making gun control laws and talking about guns and swapping them and how all of these other things are just confusions of the issue, when what we need to focus on is these dangerous consumer products, which are handguns.
Robert, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thanks for listening. 614-292-8513 if you'd like to give us a call, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Arkady, what about the states' rights issues regarding the concealed weapons and also regarding the stings on gun show sales?
Well, I think that, you know, on the issue of concealed weapons, you know, the measure that Ken was talking about earlier, the Thune Amendment, concealed carry reciprocity, right now in Ohio, Ohio has chosen to recognize the concealed carry permits of people from 18 other states that meet the same kinds of standards that Ohio has when it issues gun-carrying permits. And the standards, you know, Ken mentioned that You know, most states, more than 40 states, do have concealed carry, but the standards for issuing the permits varies greatly. And what this measure would have done is take away from states the ability to set standards that are appropriate that they want to have about who can carry guns. So in Ohio, for example, if local law enforcement thinks that an applicant is an alcoholic or a drug addict, they don't have to issue a license. Ohio requires a firearm safety course before you can get the concealed carry permit. But unfortunately, many states don't have those kinds of precautions. And the question that was at issue in the Senate last year is, should people from out of state who haven't met the same standards that Ohio citizens have to meet to get a concealed carry permit be able to carry guns in Ohio? And, you know, both senators, the Democrat and the Republican, Sherrod Brown and George Voinovich, said no. Mm-hmm. That should be a decision that's up to the people of Ohio. And what the mayors believe in Mayors Against Legal Guns is that concealed carry permit standards that are right for New York may not be right for Ohio and may not be right for Montana. But what's right for Montana may not be right for New York.
Ken, what about that? All gun laws and gun registration laws and concealed weapon laws are not created equal.
Well, first, this is a distinction, and it's not a distinction without a difference. States don't have rights. States have powers. People have rights. My ability to go to church in New York City is exactly the same as my ability to go to church in Columbus. My ability to write an op-ed criticizing Mayor Bloomberg is the exact same in New York City as it is in Columbus. My constitutional right to self-defense should not be any different.
Okay.
We just don't believe that alcoholics have a right to carry guns, and we don't believe that people who've been...
It's prohibited under federal law.
Alcoholics are not prohibited under federal law. It's
chronic alcoholic drug abuse.
No drug addicts are. Alcoholics are not. People convicted of misdemeanor crimes don't get concealed carry permits in Ohio. They're allowed under federal law to carry guns. So there are different states have different standards, but if a state says, you know, even though, you know, you've been convicted of a number of misdemeanor assaults, you've gotten arrested because you've gotten drunk in bars and out of control and punched a few people, mm-hmm. and you've got a record of misdemeanor convictions, but you haven't yet been convicted of a felony and gone to prison for a year or more. If we think in our state we're not going to let that person carry a gun, that should be a decision that a state is able to make. And while there is a Second Amendment right to own a gun, we don't believe that right applies to people who've been convicted of crime.
We have an email question from Mary Ellen. She wants to know if anyone knows what percentage of guns confiscated at crime scenes have been stolen from law-abiding citizens. Does anybody know that?
I don't have that statistic, no.
Mm-hmm. I'm a little leery of statistics to begin with.
Yeah, me too.
You torture any number long enough, yep. They'll tell you what you want to hear. But no, I'm not aware of any sort of definitive figure.
Arcadi?
You know, we don't know. There are some states that require people when they've noticed that a gun has been lost or stolen to report that to police. And there's a big debate going on next to Ohio right now in Pennsylvania on that issue, where mayors and cities all over the state have passed local laws to require reporting of lost and stolen guns. The idea there is that often when a gun is traced and police go back and find the original purchaser, people will sometimes say 2 or 3 years later, my gun was stolen years ago. But in fact, often they are a straw purchaser. They mm-hmm. pass the gun into the illegal market. So requiring people to report that a gun is lost or stolen to their local police department at the time that they notice that it's lost or stolen is a good common sense precaution that can help deter people from having an excuse years later if they're actually a straw purchaser.
An issue that Mayor Bloomberg has brought up before and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has said is a problem as well is the role that U.S. guns play in the violence sweeping across at least southern or northern Mexico right now. And I had a show on that a few months ago, and a scholar from the University of Texas, El Paso, agreed that there are a lot of guns from the United States going in through Juarez and through that area down there. What about that? What sort of responsibility should the United States have in controlling the smuggling of weapons south of the border?
Well, I think it's in our own self-interest to prevent guns going south, because the methods that fuel illegal gun trafficking from the United States into Mexico are the same methods that fuel illegal gun trafficking within the United States. The ATF has identified straw purchasing and gun shows as the two leading sources of guns being illegally trafficked into Mexico, and those are the same two leading sources that it's identified of guns being trafficked in the United States. And it's a big danger at the border, because the drug war that's going on in Mexico that's being fueled by these illegally trafficked guns from the United States is causing enormous instability. And if you want to solve problems like drug trafficking into the United States or illegal immigration into the United States, we've really got to get control of the guns that are fueling the cartel violence. By taking these actions, by cracking down on illegal sales at gun shows, by closing the gun show loophole, by cracking down on straw purchasing, by giving ATF the resources it needs to meet its own inspection goals, that won't only make people in Mexico safer, it will make people in the United States much safer.
Ken, we just have about a minute left. I wanted to give you a whack at that.
Sure. Well, I mean, Mayor Bloomberg on April 28th called the Arizona immigration law national suicide. Certainly an important part of stopping gun trafficking south of the border is going to be controlling our own borders. When we're talking about these drug gangs down there, they're getting weapons from their military, from their version of the National Guard. They're getting full automatics, rocket launchers. I even heard about a tank. I mean, yes, we have a responsibility to make sure we are not exporting guns illegally, but it's such a small percentage of what is fueling the violence down there.
Okay. That's about all the time we have. I want to say thanks to my guests, Arkady Gurney from the City of New York, Special Advisor to Mayor Bloomberg. Arkady, thanks for joining the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Ken Hansen of the Buckeye Firearms Association. Ken, thanks for staying with us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Appreciate
Sorry about
it.
The voice.
No problem. And the City of Columbus Chief of Police, Distelswag, thank you so much for being with us in the studio today.
Thank you.
All righty. That's all the time we have today. All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. Thank you. Next Fresh Air, New York Times reporter Scott Shane tells the story of the American-born Muslim cleric known to have inspired the Times Square bomber and the army psychiatrist who killed 13 people at Fort Hood. Once seen as a leader of moderate Islam, he's now a jihadist hiding in Yemen, regarded as so dangerous he's targeted for killing by the CIA. Join us.
Fresh Air begins at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Kappa, presenting the Four Bitchin' Babes with their current show, Divination, where music, laughter, and girlfriends reign. They'll bring their girl group harmonies and social commentary to the Southern Theater Sunday, May 23rd. More at kappa.com.
WOSU Public Media presents the Columbus Metropolitan Club's Wednesday Forum tomorrow at noon. Ohio Attorney General Richard Cordray discusses consumer advocacy and taking on Wall Street. Visit columbusmetroclub.org for tickets and more information. 62 degrees in downtown Columbus. Cloudy skies today and a slight chance of rain throughout the day, a high of 65. Clouds tonight with a good chance of rain and a low of 53. Good morning from WOSU. It's 11 o'clock.
Gay and transgender residents of Ohio could get a break if state lawmakers approve a bill that would ban discrimination in the workplace and housing. The House passed the measure last fall, and the bill has been waiting for Senate action ever since. Proponents say they're asking for the same protections as African Americans and women. Opponents say that it would force certain values on employers and set them up for discrimination if they don't go along with it. Learn more about House Bill 176 in a few minutes on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.